Hey, Ted here. Don't forget, climate strike, September 20th. Find an action to take part in. Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of September 16th, 2019. Today, we're happy to be joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. So, Mariah, have you ever heard of a magazine called The New Yorker?
I have indeed.
You have indeed.
I have my subscription.
Indeed. You have indeed. Yes. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the logo of the New Yorker is the famous Knickerbocker looking through his monocle at the butterfly, right? And that's Mr. Eustace Tilley, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Eustace Tilley would flip his stovepipe hat if he understood what the New Yorker has done in the last week or so. So let me tell you a little story about a guy named Jonathan Franzen, who is an author, a very highbrow kind of guy, writes these, you know, important literary books. He's a bird watcher. This past week, he wrote a piece, basically, I think it's the culture, whatever the culture section of The New Yorker magazine is, but it was about climate change, and the article was not well received, was it, Mariah? Did you get a chance to see the article or any of the reaction to it?
Yeah, it's definitely sent the world a buzzing. It's a hard article to read. I mean, it's well written, of course, but you know, the thrust of the article is that there's no hope, and so why should we do anything, right? I mean, it's obviously way more nuanced than that, but
Can I read you the exact words that the guy put in The New Yorker?
Yeah.
I happen to have it in front of me. So this guy writes, "If you care about the planet and about the people and animals who live on it, there are two ways to think about this coming devastation. You can keep on hoping that catastrophe is preventable and feel ever more frustrated or enraged by the world's inaction. Or you can accept that disaster is coming and begin to think what it means to have hope." By which hope meaning, basically, he's going to recommend that you save the birds in your backyard. Right? So is that the kind of, I find that kind of stuff difficult to read.
Well, and there's a lot of things in this article. I mean, we should definitely, you know, it's worth reading because it certainly makes you think. But you know, he says at one point, he says the planet is still marvelously intact, still basically normal. And I read that and I'm thinking, unless you live in Bahamas, right? Or unless or maybe Puerto Rico, or, you know, some of the places like that are dealing with massive, problems with food and, you know, monsoons. or dry spells, right? Like it's so just completely myopic from his own worldview, and that's it. And
well, that's what it looks like from the 34th floor of New Yorker headquarters in downtown Manhattan, right? Everything looks pretty good.
Like everything looks pretty normal, you know. And then he goes on to sort of say that it's going to get very bad, but maybe not too soon, and maybe not for everyone, maybe not for me. Right. Well, okay. Sure. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's good. True. It might not affect you. So therefore, why should we do anything? And I know I'm taking that statement out of context, right? He has a lot more context. He's not saying, well, it's not going to affect me, why should I care? But you know, there are some, you could definitely see there's this narrow worldview that's that of his from his perception without thinking about the world as a whole and how this is all affecting
and
people the world over.
And there's so much there to unpack, right? I mean, to your point, this is in one of the most prestigious outputs of, you know, places where you can get stuff in the country. And this guy hasn't looked beyond the end of his nose to figure out what the meaning of life is. He's just writing it based on what he thought about over. And he goes so far as to say that he runs doesn't say computer models, but he runs models in his head of how
in his
things.
Head.
It's like, oh, gee, I do that too, and you know.
And New Yorker has gotten a lot of flack in the press for publishing this. You know, why? How people have really said, how could you support something like this, New Yorker? It's hard because the flack is sort of, he's not a scientist, right? How can he be sort of making these projections? And, like I said, it's a thought piece. It does sort of challenge you to sort of think about things. He does present some of the science, which is straight up, right? Like we are in a dire situation. 30 years ago, we could have acted indefinitely.
But man, a lot of the stuff that I said that saw was that he didn't get the science right, even, right? And somehow the case he's making is that this 2 degrees thing is a complete everything ends, right? Once you reach 2 degrees of warming, and of course, various people said no, if it's 1.9 versus 2.1, we still have to keep fighting, right? It's not like we can give up.
Yeah, I mean, like I guess though it's hard to say. You know, he does talk about sort of some of the modeling done by the IPCC, and it's all very conservative, right? Because the scientists aren't going to say something unless they're very certain it's going to happen. And so a lot of the modeling is conservative, which has left open some of the places
worst case
for denial,
right?
Yeah, I think he sort of cites that.
It seems as if there is, this represents a strain of climate denial that needs to be recognized and called out. So there's outright climate denial that our Mango president uses. You know, he calls it a hoax. I mean, all these things, just the science isn't real. The scientists are just faking it. Right? They're just trying to keep the grants alive. This is all made up. Right? That's one strain of climate denial. There's another strain of climate denial that says, oh, the game's already over. Don't bother reducing carbon emissions, right? And this, I think, falls into that kind of mode. I mean, I've seen it called doomism, you know, as in we're all doomed and why worry about it? Sort of like Edgar Allan Poe and the Mask of the Red Death. Let's just, you know, go have a party inside the castle, right? Because everything is gone. And that is a really seductive kind of statement for a lot of people, right? Because they don't understand the issue. They say, we really can't do anything about it anymore. Maybe we just need to build some seawalls and hope for the best. That is complacent and, as they say, a form of rejecting action. No?
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you, that argument?
Well, I mean, you know, he's essentially saying he doesn't believe in there's a building burning. Well, just get as far away from you that as you can. Don't try and save anyone. Right. There's no hero in this, in the way he writes about it, because he's saying, well, we should just give up and it's not worth fighting for. Right. And that's just awful. Right. How do you go through life saying, well, let's just sit and wait for it to happen to us. Right. I mean,
So it seems to me that there's the specifics of this Frenzen article, Jonathan Frenzen's article, but there's a lot to be unhappy with in what he has specifically written. There's also the question of, you know, the way our media, now writ large, right? You begin to sound kind of like a Trumper, say, oh, media's all fake, the lamestream media. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying I read The New Yorker. I oftentimes find the articles in it are quite interesting, right? Well written, interesting. But this is an enormously powerful publication that continues to appeal to middle-aged white men to write in defined culture. Right? I mean, a lot of the reaction that I saw to this Frenzen article was anger at the fact that yet again, older men get to define what we all think about climate change. Is that fair?
Yeah. I even saw something that kind of harkened back to Rachel Carson and said, you know, even back when she started writing about climate issues, she was sort of attacked by all of these white men who, not climate issues, sorry. She was writing obviously about DDT and sort mm-hmm. of pollution. And, you know, they basically were saying that she was trying to stoke fear and that she was motivated by, you know, the wrong things. She was right. trying to poison the commons for profit, right? And so it's like any time of sort of female kind of gets, not of course not any time, but some of the thrust was like the men's opinion, the white man male's opinion is sort of revered and honored and respected a little bit more than an angry woman might be.
I think that and I agree with you. The voice, we've spoken many times about on this show about our current new hero, Mary Anise Hegler. I mean, she's, you know, you don't want to put too much weight on her personal story, right? Because there's lots of other, you know, there's women of color, there was a LGBTQ question in the climate debate about how climate affects people in that category. And that, I mean, there are indigenous tribes, there are so many other voices. I guess what I'm trying to get at, I'm groping towards, is to say that as climate hawks and as people in the culture, we need to be cognizant of when we're being fed high culture by the New Yorker and say, okay, that's fine, but there are other voices, and to somehow elevate those other voices to the point where they also have cultural currency, you know, impact, no?
To me, the biggest danger here is that you read this article and you walk away thinking, oh, I agree with him, so I'm not going to do anything about climate change. You know, he's right. I mean, I think I don't want to simplify what he's saying. He does say that there are, you know, there's still a strong practical and ethical case for reducing carbon emissions. We can always stave off some of the worst effects of climate change by reducing emissions. But he's basically saying, let's not put all of our efforts and do, you know, everything within our power toward this. Let's think about other things as well.
Although that's a logical fallacy of some kind of zero sum game, right? That either we put all of our money into adaptation or all of our money into mitigation, and we can't do both. The whole argument is to do both, right?
Right, exactly. But you know, it's well reasoned enough and it's well presented enough that my fear is that someone walks away thinking like, yeah, this article really resonated with me. I agree. Oh, yeah. So this is a reason why I don't need to do a whole lot for climate change. I can, you know, do a little bit, but.
I know people who on first reading had exactly that reaction, right? They accepted the guy sort of, you know, what he was saying at face value and said, well, there you go. I mean, that's a legitimate marker, and that is a danger. But how do you combat that danger?
You get more perspectives, as you say, right? That's the whole point, is that there should be more voices and more perspectives coming from a diverse array of presenters in The New Yorker that inform the dialogue in ways that also make you think, but, you know, aren't just from the single white male's perspective.
What does it say about The New Yorker itself that it's so myopic that it can't recognize that? You know, and it has to be told from the outside that, hey, Jonathan Franzen's the wrong guy. I mean, what else does it extend to? Is it like we love opera, but it's all written by, you know, some guy? I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, there's many places The New Yorker comments on and has tremendous impact. And if they got it pretty far wrong. Now, of course, The New Yorker publishes Bill McKibben.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and I mean, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to attack The New Yorker too much because I know that they also do. I don't think that they're, you know, completely 100% only accepting white, you know, white males.
This is true.
Authors, right? They do have a variety of perspectives, and they do a lot for cultural support and diversity support and so on and so forth.
That is true.
You know, I don't want to make too grand a sweeping statement against the New Yorker, but I mean, and again, I think that's sort of the danger of this article, and this is probably some of what has gotten people so worked up, is that it's well written and well reasoned, and even the New Yorker was like, huh, yeah, this is a good piece to publish, and.
But so
you know, maybe they needed to sit on it for. Maybe they should have waited, like, you know, really thought about it and maybe thrown it out there to a couple of people and vetted it before they published it, so that they could sort of push back on it a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, because again, there's no the quality of the writing is there. It's just the inability. I mean, does the New Yorker have a responsibility to publish? Upbeat and optimistic is the wrong word, but pieces like this that are clearly have a negative impact. I mean, what's the justification for publishing something, you know, from a that probably doesn't have a net benefit to, I don't know, the entire human project, I guess. I don't know.
So Franzen in the article kind of addresses that, right? You know, he says that some climate activists argue that if we publicly admit that the problem can't be solved, it will discourage people from taking any ameliorative action at all. And he compares that to religious leaders who fear that without the promise of eternal salvation, people won't bother to behave well. And he says, well, I know a lot of people who, you know, don't have a religious leader that's or don't believe in eternal salvation, and they still behave well because they believe in being a good person. And so he sort of thinks that, you know, maybe instead of denying reality, we should tell ourselves the truth.
But I mean, his reality, forgive me for interrupting, but I mean, his reality is that once we hit 2 degrees, everything is bad, right? The world is lost. And I think that that steps over the idea that there is a continuum of badness that will continue to get worse, and that 2 degrees, the famous 2-degree target, is not something written in stone. It's just a measure, and that if it was, even if we went past 2 degrees, we would want to prevent going to 4 degrees. So there's always reason, you know, to be. So it's not as if we say, well, the battle's lost. And I think that's, to me, that seems like it's the fundamental fallacy of the piece.
Yeah, it does. I mean, he basically says there's no way we have the political will to overcome, to do what we need to do as rapidly as we need to do it. But he says, you know, that if we continue to think that we can't, that we can do something about this, that it makes it every, he says, it's everyone's overriding priority forever. And he thinks that will create a sort of complacency, that by, you know, voting for green candidates and riding a bicycle to work and not traveling, avoiding air travel, you'll think that you've done everything you can for the only thing worth doing. And he goes on to say, whereas if you sort of accept the reality that the planet will soon overheat to the point of threatening civilization, there's a lot more you should be doing. So he thinks that sort of if it's this thing that you feel like you have to forever work toward, it can be almost demotivating. Whereas if you think, okay,
I'm having a tough time buying it.
Yeah, I think this is where it kind of like sort of falls apart here, where you're sort of like,
I mean, I think for better or worse, it seems to me that dealing with this problem is the first job forever until we get through it. I don't think you can walk away from it. And as I've said, this is a 100-year project, right? Society has to be focused on dealing with the issues until it's dealt with, and then we move on.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he's sort of saying, well, why don't we just try and make the planet enjoy the planet that we have for as long as we can, right? I mean,
that's
the issue with this, is he's looking at it from like the 45th floor of the building in New York and saying like, I mean, it looks pretty normal to me, so why don't we just enjoy what we've got? I mean, again, I'm putting words in his mouth, but I think maybe that's kind of what he's getting at when he says there's a whole lot more you should be doing. It's like, well, why don't you focus on the immediate problems, you know, versus saving for retirement, right? Let's, you know.
I mean, I don't know. I guess the for that, me,
the retirement was analogies, like, you know, why don't you rebuild your house and make it great versus saving for retirement. I think that's a lot of times people use that analogy, where addressing climate change is sort of something so far in the future, it's hard for people to really get behind it or support it.
Well, I guess it seems to me that one of the take-home lessons of this Friends in the New Yorker episode suggests that we need to continuously work to expand the set of places we get input about climate, open ourselves to new ideas about what it means to address the climate change, who climate change is going to affect. As we've said, I mean, that typically typically focuses on the dispossessed, the voiceless currently are the ones we ought to be listening to. And so that's a place to go. I mean, is to try to seek out the voices of the people who are not, I mean, Google environmental justice and you'll find stuff to read. I mean, there's lots and lots of things. And I think that friends didn't get it wrong. That's what I'm saying.
I agree.
Well,
I
will call up the editor of the New Yorker and tell him our opinion that we decided he was wrong, and he should. What I'm gonna do is nominate you to write a think piece for the New Yorker, Mariah, so you can send it down. Okay, they'll need that by next Tuesday if you
all
can
right,
jump
yeah,
on
I'm,
it.
I'm
okay,
I'm on it.
All right. Well, look, we'll put it down there. We'll put up links to most of what we talked about at the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us on your smartphone using almost any of the modern podcast distribution apps and, of course, on Apple Podcasts. You can send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Please let us know what you're thinking, what you'd like to hear us talk about on the show. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next 10 years under a plan that is both equitable and just, using regulations, investments, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everyone for listening to our literary criticism of the New York Times. Talk to you again soon. I'm New York. Oh, there I go. That's why I'm not on the New Yorker editorial board. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.